Chapter 3. Rabbi, you have a flat tire, when the chaplain is not in charge. Even in the context of nearing the end of life, the patient and I have to sort out the nature of the relationship between us, no matter how transient it may turn out to be. Part of that relationship is the power imbalance between me as the professional and the patient. The patients are much more vulnerable than I, often at the mercy of others to be moved or fed. Beyond that, of course, they, or at least their families, are consciously confronting death. I, on the other hand, am perceived as crisis-free, physically strong, more sure in my religious beliefs, and, of course, healthy. Note, I said perceived as. Also, as with any clergy, people tend to see me as an authority figure for good or for ill. I do what I can to mitigate this unequal footing by asking if they wish to have a visit from me in the first place. Some patients who perhaps have not made any decisions for themselves all day may regain some of their dignity by asking me to leave the room and come back another day, if at all. If I am invited to stay, I offer them choices as to what we might do, such as converse, pray, sing, play a game such as Scrabble, or just quietly be with each other. Even so, it is tricky to offer help without the patient feeling inferior, patronized, or even more powerless or humiliated. Or they might feel obligated to say the right thing about their beliefs in front of clergy. In fact, the word help is itself demeaning, and so I say in my introductory remarks, "Can I be of any service to you?" Thus, I try to approach them as humbly as possible. I got this idea of using the word service instead of be of help from Dr. Rachel Naomi Remen, a doctor who writes about spiritual approaches to the medical world. She says, when you help, you see life as weak. When you fix, you see life as broken. When you serve, you see life as whole. I sent this quote in an email to the whole hospice team, as once a week I send a spiritual quote of the week, for a bit of uplift and welcome relief from the strictly work-related emails we all get. Every so often, a patient will momentarily turn around our relationship by making me the more vulnerable one, or making me the one being helped or even spiritually enlightened. If you're reading this book to see if you want to be a hospice chaplain, and you're interested in being in charge, then this job would not be for you. I'm very glad when the patient can take charge, because it can raise her self-worth and sense of meaning. Miss Betty was an ardently devout Baptist, recently confined to her bed in the same nursing home that had Hotel California playing in the background. She was a favorite among the staff because of her devotion and exuberant personality. All you had to do after a bad day was go see Miss Betty and you would feel refreshed. It was a great blow to staff when she was admitted to hospice. They at first resisted the fact that she could no longer amble along the halls and had become bedbound. However, she still was very enthusiastic about having anyone come in who was interested in prayer and eagerly beckoned them to enter her room. She took the lead when I asked whether she preferred to hear me pray or have me listen to her do the praying. I usually do not even mention the latter choice, but I had a hunch she might take me up on it, and she did. First, she started to recite the Our Father, and I almost stopped paying attention to her exact words, figuring she was just going to trot through the entire prayer. But then I saw that midway into it, she had segued into spontaneous prayer that included me in it. After thanking God for bringing me to her, she then asked God to provide me comfort and peace. I thanked her for invoking God's blessing, murmuring that I usually am the one who does that for others. Betty smiled knowingly. I also told her that I was comforted by her asking God to bless me, and it was true. Having to almost always build up the other person's strength can sap my own, and so the occasional boost from the other direction replenishes my own stores. The patients themselves on occasion do all they can to preserve their own dignity and independence. Their wealth, too, can cut into the power imbalance, giving them a sense of more options to consider. They can, for example, employ higher quality help for longer periods of time, and have more material comforts like a fine home with a gorgeous view, and more emotional comforts like knowing their children will be well provided for. One of these wealthier patients was Marilyn, related to a former government leader, and who lived in a log cabin the family built by themselves. I saw a photograph of her and an American president on the wall by the entrance, signed by him. The former winery Marilyn's family had owned had been on the property, but all the physical evidence of it was gone, except for a wooden sign in back of the cabin, with indistinct letters, which were well on the way to perishing, given enough snow and rain and baking hot sun. Nothing was there now in the back except unruly grasses. How I loved going over to the cabin. Every wall, floor, countertop, and table were made of burnished wood, looking amber-colored when the sun enhanced it like deftly applied makeup. I was most taken with a spiral staircase, also of wood, that led from the living room to the patient's bedroom. During our visit, she gave me a memoir she had written about taking a substantial monetary gift and using it all to get a boat, hire a crew, and tour Greece for one summer. As weak as she was, she even signed the book for me. I felt moved, as I might have been one of the last recipients of her autograph. But what surprised me much more is that when she said, "It's time for me to rest now," she did not stay on the first floor. Without help from the aide, she methodically went step by step, on and on, up the tightly winding spiral staircase, and at last, having conquered the obstacle, made it to her bed. The aide agreed it was very uncomfortable, but that this routine made Marilyn happy. Although the mantra in hospice work is to reduce pain, as with everything else, there are exceptions and trade-offs. She found comfort from an activity that indicated she was very much alive and still in the game. Perhaps it counterbalanced the mounting indignities that assaulted her as she deteriorated day by day. Electing to endure pain can mean retaining power. In addition to a patient's own efforts, a way for me to voluntarily mitigate the power imbalance is to let my patients be the ones who initiate personal questions. The very act of asking a question puts the questioner in the driver's seat, allowing them to take control of the dialogue. More importantly, getting personal information helps him feel connected with me. I freely answer unless I feel the question is unduly personal or that the truth about my life might upset patients. Their most common initial questions are, "What church do you belong to? Are you married? Do you have children? How can you do this work?" And non-rhetorical ones like, "There is nothing like a mother's love, is there?" When I say I'm Jewish, the most popular response from Christians has been, "That's all right with me. We're children of the same God." Somehow, such comments about my being Jewish, as being all right, smacks of a smidgen of prejudice on their part, as when I hear Christians say, "Some of my best friends are Jewish." Concerning the question as to whether I have children, I always like to have a little fun with that, and I respond with, "Not last time I checked." This gets a chuckle and avoids the awkward silence that would often otherwise inevitably ensue. Bad enough that I am a Jew, not having children puts me even more at the fringes of the norm. As for a mother's love coming in first place, well, let us just say concerning my own mother, that precious little mothering made it through the convolutions of her mental illness. So answering the question literally about my own mother's love would not exactly be comforting to the patient. I mean, I had the kind of mother who, for sport, guessed when various people we knew would die. So I just smile and nod, dreaming what it would have been like to have had such a mother as the patient's. As for how I can do this work, these anecdotes speak for themselves. I usually answer that being able to connect with them and be with all kinds of people is very rewarding. A very different illustration of a patient taking the upper hand is for that patient to come off of hospice alive and to be aware of it. Mr. Lin comes to mind, a Chinese gentleman who graduated from hospice, the informal lingo we use for making it off alive. Not once, but two times. All of his life, he had beat the odds against surviving, including his role in World War II. When Mr. Lin first came onto hospice, I found him working in his backyard garden, which was but one tiny sample of all the adjoining farmland he owned. He contentedly showed me the various vegetables he was tending and poo-pooed the nurse's admonition that he should not overexert himself. Finding a hospice patient outside, let alone engaged in physical action, was a novelty. Meanwhile, an intimidatingly abundant collection of cats, which almost crossed the line to being an infestation of them, were lolling about on the grass. Naturally, they frequented Mr. Lin's property because he could not resist the pleasure of seeing the felines indulge in his culinary giveaways. The next time I came to see Mr. Lin, the cool day favored going indoors. There I found an even more abundant and even more overwhelming collection. A phalanx of blue and white Chinese vases spanning from the innocuously small to the grotesquely large. They hogged the floor, dominated all available tabletops, lined the walls, and practically did all but invade the bathroom. Whenever our conversation lagged, all I had to do was point to a few vases and he would unravel a story connected with where they came from or how he came to buy them. He would explain how high a level of quality they had. If they are smooth, they are of the highest quality. He informed me as he had me touch one to see for myself. And they must be blue and white. If you see other colors on them, that's just for tourists, he said with displeasure. Moving on to a more personal matter, he mentioned that when his wife was alive, she complained about my having so many vases all over the house. I then made my own move to personal statements. Well, my husband and I are the same way. He loves to save everything, and I find the house too crowded. How Mr. Lin felt about his vases has given me more understanding about my husband's feelings of the larger-than-average quantity of items we own, that he labels as having sentimental value. Over the course of a year, Mr. Lin always had something new to talk about. Once I saw some martial arts on his television. As soon as I commented on that, he showed me how I might save my life by using some martial art techniques. He said if someone jumped on my back, rather than lean back in an attempt to throw him off, that I should lean forward, continuing the motion my opponent started. I'll have to keep that in mind. When there was no outside stimulus to conversation, such as the vases or the television, he frequently told me with pride about his narrow escapes in World War II aboard ship. These escapes were from both disease and from enemy fire. He also proudly mentioned how later in life he defeated death despite various other maladies. He won over death again when he graduated from hospice over a year after he signed on. He then came on yet again for several months and emerged victorious once more in his battle against death. When I left Princeton Hospice about a year after that, he still had not come back on. For all I know, he could still be triumphantly negotiating with antique dealers for new collectibles to add to his blue and white retinue. Upsetting the power imbalance works well when I'm the one letting it happen, but there are less benign situations where someone else on hand, other than the patient and family, tries to take on the role of providing spiritual support in a dominating way. Not only do such persons usurp my role, they are, as faux chaplains, engaging in just the opposite of what clinically trained chaplains do. That is, despite best intentions, some people actually are preying on rather than praying for the patient and or family, thus using the power imbalance for ill. The problem of this misuse may be most clear in a context outside of hospice. A few weeks or so after the horrors of 9/11, victims' families gathered in the renovated Central Railroad Terminal in Liberty State Park in Jersey City. A slew of social services were there to provide comfort to them in various ways, including a meal and a chance to pick up urns for their loved ones' ashes. Chaplain organizations, including the Association of Professional Chaplains, Protestant, and the National Association of Jewish Chaplains, had summoned their members to help out with this event and circulate among the families to offer their non-judgmental listening ears. I spent my time listening to families vent their anger and shock and feelings of senselessness. What I found most appalling was that some of the religious people on hand, not trained to be chaplains, were viewing the families as ripe for being ready to know the Lord. They handed out pamphlets galore and delivered their message, but did not lend their ears. Yes, when people are in crisis, they may find meaning and support by belief in a caring God. But people in crisis are vulnerable and have less capacity to make decisions, including theological ones. A crisis can heighten ambivalence toward religion as well as resolve it. As for the goal to save more souls, I have grave ethical objections to an ends justify the means approach. I protest the promotion of religion in general, and or a specific religion in particular when people are hurting. It is the height of disrespect and an attempt at mind control, in my view. In short, I consider this to be spiritual scamming. Back to hospice. This same problem of an unsolicited dosing of religion happened with a fellow named Bob. Along with his wife Jill, I would see him in his upper-middle-class home, often resting in a bed which dominated the living room, watching an old movie on his generously sized television, stationed near the foot of his bed. The bedrooms were upstairs and the bed was moved downstairs, so there would be no need to transport him from one floor to another. During my second visit, his wife was there as usual, but this time she was with a friend Anna she had told me about, who was very religious. Uh-oh. Jill jubilantly informed me that yesterday she prayed with us for a whole hour. Now, you might think that such news would be a chaplain's dream, but that is not the truth at all. A red flag went right up. Part of my job is to get at the deeper levels of what is really going on in terms of how religion might camouflage or cloak other concerns. Jill urged me to go over to Bob and sing some hymns, because the first time I visited, he hummed a few along with me in his resonant, emphatic voice. As I approached the bed with Anna and Jill forming a backdrop, I was thinking about that one-hour prayer session and how such a lengthy interaction of any kind, religious or not, would have severely taxed his powers of concentration. At that first visit of mine, I quickly observed that about 10 minutes of interaction was all he could tolerate. After that upper limit, he needed some quiet, which is quite common with persons at that time of life. So, I thought, despite the wife's urging and Bob's fine unison singing, that I should offer him a choice between hymns and non-religious music, or even none at all. And sure enough, he went for the secular option. Not only that, he said his top choice would have been country music, but regrettably I had to tell him I did not have that genre in my paltry repertoire. But you may well ask, what was going on when he sang along with my hymns during the first visit? Since he had dementia, just hearing a well-known melody of any kind might have triggered his response. Or it could have been he wanted to please his wife Jill, as religion seemed to be much more of a comfort to her than to him. Or maybe he was trying to please me, the chaplain. Or maybe that time, but not the subsequent time, he did want to connect with God. See how complicated religion can become? But come to think of it, he expressed ambivalence even then via a critique of my in-house performance. After I had concluded some spirituals, he said, "That was fine, but don't make that your day job. And besides, you have gray in your hair." It is very common, by the way, for persons with dementia to be uninhibited and tell it like it is. The irony here, of course, is that I have made singing part of my day job. I am not sure why he had to add the discouraging part about my gray hair. Maybe he was indulging in a bit of schadenfreude, trying to level the playing field of our relative misfortunes. That was his own bid in shifting the power imbalance between caregiver and care receiver. The plot thickened when Jill's devout friend came over that second time I was there. She immediately launched into extensive preaching to Jill and me about how prayer heals. She was so insistent I felt cornered and trod upon. Just think how any patient ambivalent toward religion would feel under those circumstances. I felt frustrated because I think prayer should be about coping with reality, not indulging a fantasy. I resent any theology that implies God helps some people, who presumably are not spiritually superior, over others. I get really steamed when people say, "God rescued so-and-so from a disaster like Hurricane Katrina, 9/11, or a school shooting." I cannot countenance this folk theology because everyone forgets that means God did not rescue the vast majority of those hapless guys who did not make it, let alone prevent the tragedy from hitting a populated area in the first place. If God could intervene for some people, then why not for others? Or better yet, why not for everyone? There has to be some way of thinking about God besides being the rescuer or not being one. If I survived a hurricane or beat the odds to live much longer than forecasted, I could not then conclude that God was my salvation, because it would mean God cruelly, or at least capriciously, was not the savior for all those other equally deserving souls. Extensive silence, not talk, is the hallmark of a professional spiritual caregiver. And this faux chaplain was not letting Jill's voice be heard. Anna then approached the bed to continue her sermon. Given Bob's rejection of religious singing, I felt he was literally a captive audience, bedbound unless moved by a caregiver to a wheelchair. As Jill's friend urged me to sing hymns to him, I had to firmly say that Bob did not wish to hear them. She did not insist, but continued to tell Jill about prayer and examples of how it performed healing. I was concerned about what she was implying about the patient's chances for survival, because once someone enrolls on hospice, the family knows that we're talking about the last half year or so of a person's life, given the usual course of the disease. The conflict I felt was that her friend was confusing the issue. No matter how well-intentioned, this could make Jill's grieving more painful. "Why didn't the prayers work?" she might lament when the time came to mourn. "Why didn't God hear me?" Added to the death itself could be the spiritual pain of a God who did not deliver, or even worse, had spurned her as unworthy. At the moment of my visit, the spouse, and especially the patient, were under duress, and I felt so duty-bound to speak up and say to Anna, as golden as her intentions might have been, I hear your examples of how prayer can heal, but you may be raising false hopes because sometimes bad things happen even when we pray they not happen. She murmured agreement, but I am sure she did not appreciate this nuancing of her message. I imagine she was probably quite taken aback, given that I was introduced as a religious person. A chaplain's lot is not always a straightforward one. I felt awkward in this case, jockeying for the position of taking the lead in pastoral care. It did feel strange advocating for less, not more, prayer. Moreover, I was taking the chance that I was depriving the spouse of a short-term source of comfort. Yet I felt compelled to assert myself this way because I calculated that the comfort was counterfeit. Brief relief now, but down the road, long-lasting feelings of having been deceived, followed by disillusionment over God's powers or God's love for her. The patient was deteriorating, and it was extremely unlikely that he would improve, let alone live for a long time. He died about a month later. My duty was to avoid misguided hope and to facilitate appropriate hope. That kind of hope is about clients feeling they have accomplished cherished goals or feeling assured that their legacy will be passed on through their loved ones. Their hope might be, if that's what they themselves believe, that they will continue on in an afterlife or even that a miracle might happen. This next story is about a power reversal, but in this instance, it has nothing to do with me voluntarily leveling the playing field or with anyone trying to usurp my role. I had pulled into a cemetery parking lot in Woodbridge on a steamy midsummer's day, being sure to park in a space which granted the sanctuary of shade. There, I had counted on placidly awaiting the arrival of the hearse and mourners. As a car pulled in next to mine, the occupants couldn't roll down their windows fast enough to excitedly unveil the news that I had a flat tire. Sure enough, I did, with a big fat nail unforgivingly entrenched there. So much for my meditative reprieve in the shade, but no matter, I figured I could still get in place behind the hearse and make it to the nearby gravesite. As my car uncertainly but obediently limped along, I'm sure in the other cars the topic, "The rabbi has a flat," provided a welcome relief from what lay ahead. I, meanwhile, was thinking about the grave topic of the three A's, and that at least I was in one of the safest, if unlikeliest, places imaginable to wait for them. I was hoping they would not think it was my idea of a prank. "Hey, I'm at the cemetery and I have a flat." "Yeah, righto, we don't have time for your kind." But right after the burial, two nephews of the deceased rushed over with me the few yards to my car, and with the burial mound in full view, said they would change the tire. In 3 minutes flat, they took off the offending tire and put on the spare, thus sparing me a long and lonely second opportunity to meditate as I awaited the AAA. Members of the family, with the heretofore aloof funeral director trotting close behind, clustered round to say how it was such a shame that this happened. They seemed unaware of the incongruity of how trivial this was compared to the rite of passage they had just gone through, to wit, the sacred conveyance of their loved one to her final destination. With the family helping me as well as my helping them, perhaps it was some sort of comfort to all present that clergy and mourners alike share the same road, with plenty of detours and potholes before we have to pull over for good at the very end. As you will see in Chapter 4, one of those potholes is dementia, which presents a challenge much more complicated than assuring the patient that I am not there to take control. This is because you cannot play by the rules of this world anymore when patients can no longer make sense of them. You can only play by the rules that operate in that patient's reality, which sometimes only they themselves understand.